Cinephile. Nicolas Cage.
Very sincere group of film enthusiasts who are proudly cinephiles.
Oh my goodness, Warren Beatty apparently read the wrong name. This is incredible. Moonlight won Best Picture.
Cinephile. Ethan Hawke.
It's kind of like I'm a professional actor and I direct for love. There's so much in this world that's dividing us, and music is one of those great tools that brings us together.
All right.
There's baseball and World War II. It's kind of a dream.
Cinephile, the Adnan Virk Movie Podcast.
All right, yes. Why wasn't I still recording?
That would have been gold. Could have run that as the open.
Cooper's talent for writing and directing has been hiding in plain sight. After this five-star treat of a picture, consider The Secret out. That's from Allison Rowan of The Herald. A Star is Born is one of the films we'll be reviewing this time on Cinephile. As always, thanks so much for checking us out. Please do give us some love on iTunes. I rank my movies at a four-minute release. Please rank them at a five stars. Let us know what you like. Let us know what you don't like. And thank you to the one guy who said, you know what? I've listened to a handful and I'm out, because he was so upset with me because I left during Hereditary, went to go get chicken fingers, because if you're that porous a film critic that you had to leave to go get food, I'm not listening to your podcast anymore. Thank you for the honesty. Appreciate the feedback. I will never do so again. Big news coming out of our man, Ben Lyons, and check out his podcast, Lyons Den. I just listened. I know Ricky Passmore retweeted it. Check out Cinephile ESPN, of course, for all the latest from our pod, and we also give love to other pods. Ricky had Tommy Wiseau on and Greg Sestero. They've got a new movie out. Of course, he is the guy who did the Disaster Artist. Very odd and off the cuff and strange, as you'd expect. So congrats to Ben. Check that out. Lyons Den Podcast 1. Here's the major news. This summer I had said to Ben, listen, Cinephile is in peril. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, I can't keep up this breakneck pace of seeing these movies, a growing family, job responsibilities. It may just be an interview-based podcast, and that's what we'll do. He said, well, what can I do to help? I said, well, I can't be driving to go see Silence on Christmas Day. I can't be going to see Phantom Thread spending 5 hours in a car. He goes, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to get you in the Broadcast Film Critics Association. I said, how are you going to do this? He goes, don't worry about it. We'll get you in there. Then you're going to get screeners. I said, really? For those who are curious, I get some screeners. For example, if Willem Dafoe is on the podcast, then the studio ends up sending me something via email, Watts Film, etc. Shape of Water, we had Richard Jenkins. I got the screener. But normally, I'm just going to the movies, as I did with The Star is Born. So I said to Ben, what can you do? So this is how good Ben is. Tuesday, I reminded him. I said, listen, now it's Oscar season. There's no chance I'm going to watch these movies. Like, Stanzi's going to need an immediate review of The Front Runner. It's going to be tough for me to see. He goes, I'll take care of it. Boom. Sarah Voorhees hooks me up. We need some information, your bio, your picture, etc., what you've done. Send back a comprehensive list. Approved. Broadcast Film Critics Association. So, you know the Critics Film Awards, which take place, the Critics' Choice? Those take place on January 11th. I can't wait to go to there, have some cocktail shrimp. And I had to sign the form, pay $100. I paid my union dues. Unlimited screeners. This is absolutely incredible news. I asked Ben, I go, how many screeners am I getting everything? He goes, dude, starting now until January, expect to get 500 to 750 pieces of mail, and it's not just going to be screeners to movies, which I guess you're supposed to keep it to yourself, but I'm including Cinephile teams. So I think Ricky and Dan, it's okay if they're involved without upsetting anybody.
Don't admit it publicly. You can just like give them to us. It's
right.
Fine.
But I took it very seriously. I had to sign the confidentiality agreement. Ben said he'll be getting letters, gifts, food, screeners, CDs, and stuffed animals.
Wait, stuffed animals aren't part of the gifts?
I don't know exactly how it works. A separate category, but it's going to be awesome. So if you want to get locked into Oscar season, trust me, Cinephile will have you covered between the brain trust of me, Dan, and Rick. A Star is Born comes roaring into theaters. It is the trailer of the year, so could not wait to see the film. And here's the good news. Bradley Cooper, in many ways, knocks it out of the park. As a director, I think he does a solid job, and he gives the actor, Bradley Cooper, the role of a lifetime. And there's a reason why actors love playing these roles, because it allows them to get down and dirty. I spoke previously about how he trained with a voice coach, and that's one of the most effective parts of the film. Not only his singing, which is excellent, but just his actual speaking voice. He speaks with this deep southern growl. He sounds like Sam Elliott, who plays his older brother in the movie, and I thought that lent a lot of authenticity to the role. He's grimy, he's dirty, he's got the great hair, he's got the scruffy beard, and he certainly seems committed as this talented singer who's also an alcoholic and battling substance abuse issues. The question now becomes, how is Lady Gaga going to do? Does she knock it out of the park? Yes, she does. She acquits herself very nicely. Obviously does really good in the musical sequences, as you'd expect. But you have to play somebody who's actually a global superstar, and she's playing this ingenue who is completely opposite of that. And that, I think that's harder to think of when you realize that. You have to play down. You're playing, not this glamorous archetype that she is, but she's playing this wannabe singer who's desperate for a chance. So I think it's actually harder to think about than people realize. And as I said, the singing and dancing is great, but just the little moments and her chemistry with Cooper really is the heart of the movie. Having said that, it is meandering at times, and I'd like to better it when it was called Walk the Line or Crazy Heart or Tender Mercies. Any of those other movies, I'm going to go ahead and watch those. People who are saying it's the best movie they've seen in years, I'm astonished by. Probably they don't get to the theater very much. And to further the point, the people have told me that it's the best movie they've seen in years. Christine Golick, shout out to Mike's wife. Weimer, who's a producer here. Claire Atkins. So I already see a theme here. A lot of white women in their 30s, 40s, and 50s all saying this is the best movie they've ever seen. So I'm clearly not that. It's not the best movie I've ever seen. I'm giving it 3 Maple Leafs because I like the chemistry and the performances. And as I tweeted, it's undeniably from Cooper's soul. He really took a lot of care in this film. Production design, costume, the music is fabulous. And here's my other hot take. Shallow, which is number one right now on iTunes, which everybody's downloading, which is a good song. I prefer Baby It's Time, which is the low-key melodic song that Bradley Cooper sings to the drag queens in the opening series of Sing. So Baby It's Time is actually the song I liked more. Stanzik already looks quizzical.
No, I'm just double-checking. Shallow's tremendous. Yeah. Maybe It's Time.
Maybe it's time.
Yeah, okay, you confused me. That song is a banger. That's Bradley Cooper. Did his own singing. Lady Gaga talked him into it. Shouts out to her. Always Remember Us This Way by Gaga.
Yes. Woo! Immediately after my wife downloaded those three, or bought them on iTunes for $1.29. Those
Spotify,
three songs.
Whatever. I got them all. Those three.
Yeah, exactly. Those three immediately. And I was surprised. I go, which is the Gaga one? And then we played it a few times again. That is actually a great song. So, it's going to get a ton of nominations. That's not surprising. At last check on Gold Derby, picture, director, actor, actress, supporting actress. Shout out to Sam Elliott. Terrific as the brother. Andrew Dice Clay, who's a liar, who says he beat out Robert De Niro for the role. There's no chance that happened. I'm sure Bob just passed on the role. He's tight with Bradley Cooper. I'm sure Bradley Cooper asked Bob. He's like, actually, I can't do it. Dice is like, I'll take it. I'm like, great. You're excellent in the movie. We know you're a dramatic actor. You're wonderful in Blue Jasmine. I'll give you that. You did not beat out De Niro for the role. I do not buy that. But yeah. The good news is Dan Stanzik has seen this movie, so I can now hand the baton to him.
Yeah, but I'm going to ask you a question, man. Send the baton right back. Okay. Who, in your opinion, won the movie?
I think Bradley Cooper.
As an actor or as a director?
As an actor.
Okay.
I think of all the Oscar chances that he's the most likely to win best
as an
actor.
Actor.
Correct. As an actor. As a director, did a solid job. But I think...
So if you had to name your biggest flaws of the movie, what would they be?
I just think it's glaring lack of originality. And it was...
Well,
utterly,
I mean, it's the third remake. Of course, it's the third remake. It's not
utterly predictable,
original.
Though. You can take some chances and zig and zag. And I would say...
I thought the emotional scenes felt rushed. I would say that there was 2 Goodwill Hunting moments where someone is literally saying to Bradley Cooper, it's not your fault. And I was like, we are trying way too hard here.
Yeah.
But I thought Gaga was excellent. The music's excellent. Something just seemed a little off. I think the biggest problem for this film is the hype was too much and it didn't live up to it. The hype is a part of your movie-going experience, and I would say they're too strong, but my words are disappointing and underwhelming.
Yeah, dancing.
I said after the film, saw with the girlfriend on Friday, she went again Monday see it with her girlfriend. She's
again,
all in.
Once again, a white woman.
Woman in her 30s. Yeah, shocker.
To make that clear.
But I said, out of 4 Maple Leafs, I don't do Maple Leafs, happy Canadian Thanksgiving, by the way.
Thank you, buddy. Had a turkey sandwich.
Yeah, nice. I said I would give it 3 stars. Someone could talk me into 3.5, but I'm not going anywhere past that. So I said 3. I'm happy to hear that you also said 3.
My wife, because if you give this 3.5, that's appalling. She also said the trailer is better than the movie, and considering the hype machine did not live up to the hype. Rick Pass, we're going to say passed on seeing A Star Is Born this opening weekend.
Opening weekend, because I was in northern Vermont for a wedding, so I will eventually get around to seeing it.
Well, look what I got for you. Cover of Entertainment Weekly, Jamie Lee Curtis, Halloween, coming soon. This will be Passmore leading off with that one.
Before we move on, we do have to say one more thing about the film.
Sure.
Bradley Cooper's actual real-life dog is his dog in the movie. And according to Mike Golick Jr., who still will eventually make his cinephile debut soon, I hope.
Has he seen
Mandy? We keep
talking
about him.
Yeah.
I think he has, good. But he said that the dog won the movie.
Are you with me that Cooper, the actor, won the movie, or are you going to go Gaga?
I think I'd go Gaga because I'm not surprised. Cooper, I know, is a great actor.
Right.
I still contend that he's not actually good looking. His fame just makes him even more good looking. I think I was more impressed with Gaga, but Cooper's going to do better in the awards circuit.
Back to his looks, I agree he's much better looking in the movie. When I saw him on Fallon today, I'm like, he's a guy with a big nose, kind of goofy looking. Like, there's really nothing special about him. In the movie, he looks hot. He's got the greasy hair. He's an alcoholic. He's beaten up. He's got a great voice. I get it. Yeah.
The fact that he lowered, as you've mentioned before on the podcast, that he lowered his voice a full octave for the role, he's probably winning Best Actor, right?
Right now, he is the favorite to win. Although,
or whoever in Bohemian Rhapsody?
Robbie Mollick has a chance, but I think our boy Gosling has a really good chance.
First man.
Which I can't wait. Opening next weekend. So I'm hoping the Canadian comes through, but I haven't even seen a star. I haven't even seen first man yet, but I'm hoping for Ryan. But yes, Cooper right now the favorite. Lady Gaga neck and neck with Glenn Close for the wife, which looks fabulous. Let's fire through some more here. Smallfoot, 2.5 Maple Leafs, amiable, decent movie, a twist in the whole idea of Bigfoot, because this is about a bunch of Yetis who see a Smallfoot, played by James Corden, the British talk show host. It's sweet and decent, and surprisingly, an animated movie that's not from Pixar, and it's actually well done. So I'll give it 2.5 Maple Leafs. Common is the best, I think, performance of them all, although LeBron James is also in the movie and does a decent job as well. So 2.5 there for Smallfoot. Also, Private Life is the one I want to talk about. Paul Giamatti, Catherine Hahn play a couple struggling with infertility. Of all the movies that opened this weekend, notably Venom and A Star is Born, the best one is Private Life. I'm giving it 3.5 Maple Leafs. It's available on Netflix, which I saw immediately Friday morning. Tamara Jenkins is the writer and director. She did a great film called The Savages with Philip Seymour Hoffman and Laura Linney. That movie came out in 2007. It has that same great mix of comedy and drama. Pitch perfect writing from Jenkins. I hope she gets nominated for an Academy Award. Giamatti, as everybody knows, listens to the podcast, I'm a huge fan of, and he's very solid in the movie. But Catherine Hahn is fantastic. She's really the one that I think steals the film as this mother who, or wannabe mother, who's so desperate to have a child. And anybody who's ever been through this type of process can appreciate just how hard it is when you can't have a child, how difficult it is to conceive, the medical procedures, IVF, just how expensive it is, and then looking for a surrogate, trying to go through adoption clinics. I mean, she's a 45-year-old woman who's known for some great comedies. So see Catherine Hahn nail this role. And as I said, the nuance of it, that really was a surprise to me. So make sure you check out Private Life. It's available on Netflix. Paul Giamatti, Catherine Hahn, a terrific cast, and it's available on Netflix. As I said, I saw it. We originally was at Sundance. Me and Ben Lyons were there, didn't get a chance to see it. But now it's available on a wide audience. And Christy Lemire, friend of Cinephile, actually messaged me on my Instagram and said she saw it too and also loved it. So I think the critics will give it a boost. I hope it finds an audience on Netflix. And one more for you. It's called Being Montgomery Clift. For those who love old Hollywood, as I do, check out this documentary. It's made by Montgomery Clift's nephew. For those who don't know who Montgomery Clift is, he was a very handsome actor back in the 50s. He's often lumped with Brando and James Dean. His best movie is called A Place in the Sun. George Stevens directed it with Liz Taylor. He's unbelievable in it. And what the documentary is really interesting about is I kept thinking of that expression that if the facts don't compete with the legend, print the legend. The story on Montgomery Clift, anybody ever asked you about him, they'd say, well, yeah, really handsome guy, good actor, but completely tortured because he was gay, ended up dying at a young age, 45, that's it. And what his nephew did is he goes, I'm going to overcome the fact that that's been history. That's what people have always said. And in fact, he was a lot more lighthearted than people realize. He actually had a great sense of humor. He was a lot happier than people realize. And yes, he was bisexual, but this wasn't something he was tormented by. At the time, he had to keep it a secret. But, you know, he shows through different videos and press clippings that sometimes people just love a narrative. And once the narrative becomes, hey, tortured actor, I mean, the New York Times obituary noted his portrayal of moody, sensitive young men. So all of a sudden it becomes, hey, this guy's a moody, sensitive person. That's who he actually is. No, no, it's called acting. And I think it's really a testament to what his nephew felt about him and what, you know, I think his family felt about him, that this isn't fair the way he was portrayed in Hollywood all this time. That, in fact, he was a happy person. He was a very loving person. And beyond the fact that he is a real symbol for gay audiences, making Montgomery Clift, I think, does an excellent job of showing what the real person was like. So make sure you check it out. And like I said, if you love movies like A Place in the Sun, From Here to Eternity is a classic. Montgomery Clift's a great actor and a great person, as this documentary makes clear. Now it's time for our special guest. His new movie is called The Oath. Behold, Ike Barinholtz. The star of the new film, The Oath. Make sure you check it out. Very funny. Written, directed, and starring Ike Barinholtz. Ike, thanks so much for your time today on Cinephile.
No, thanks for having me, brother.
The movie was very entertaining and very funny. And what I loved about it is it's very much a movie of its times. I mean, this is a character who is furious at what's happening in the Oval Office. It's very politically charged. How much of this was inspired by what's going on right now in the White House?
You know, I think it's not just the White House. It's really kind of what's going on in the country right now. And it was really after Thanksgiving a couple of years ago, after dinner, I got in this big fight with my family about politics. And I just knew that the holiday table in this country was kind of changed forever. And I wanted to kind of tell a story about that and blow it up a little bit.
You generally do blow it up because the first half of it, I'm enjoying it. It's funny. And then I said, wow, okay, Ike's going to take some chances here, not only as actor, but as writer, director. And this is going to get really wild. Was there any part of you that said, maybe I shouldn't push it to this type of limit, this type of polemic, or just say, what the hell, balls to the wall, let's do this?
I think in this day and age, if you're telling stories that are kind of reflective of what's happening, it kind of has to be all the way. You know what I mean? Just because we live in such extreme times. So you know, there was, you know, slight discussions here and there, but we really decided just to kind of throw all the spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks.
In many ways, it felt like a one-act play because so much of it takes place in the house. Just, I'm curious from a cinematic perspective, how challenging was that in terms of budgets, getting these actors? Did it feel like repertory theater? Here we go, guys. Let's just do some guerrilla filmmaking here.
There was a little bit of that. I mean, the challenge was, you know, it's easy to write a movie that takes place in one location, but the challenge is to shoot it and present it in a way where the audience doesn't get, you know, visually bored. So you know, you notice kind of the first half of the movie or so, the frames are nice and wide and the colors are kind of vibrant and there's a lot of, you know, natural light in there. And then by the end, the frames are super close and tight. And the kind of the film kind of takes this you know, dark, yellowy, orange feel to it. So it was important for us to have the physical look of the film evolve as this, or devolve, I guess, as the story does.
We're talking with Ike Barinholtz right now. Check out his new movie called The Oath. Tiffany Haddish is everywhere now, Ike, for good reason. She's so funny. She's so talented. And I love the fact you guys are in this interracial marriage, yet there's nothing unusual about that. You don't have to call attention to it. It's just she's your wife. She's very loving and caring. You guys are caught up in this crazy situation. Tell me about Tiffany and working with her.
Oh, my God, man. She's a national treasure. I'm starting a movement to put her on the $5 bill. And I know a lot of people love Abe Lincoln, but I think it's time for a change. And Tiffany's the perfect person. But, I mean, she's just, you know, when you talk to her and you hear her story and see, like, you know, how hard she's worked and how funny she is, she's infectious. And she was everyone's favorite person. And I just can't wait to see, you know, her make 100 more movies.
She's talented. The whole cast is talented. How much did you allow for ad-libbing? You as the writer and the director and the star, how much did you say, you know what, guys, I really worked on the script hard. Can we stick to it as much as possible? Or did you allow them to move a little bit?
I allowed them, you know, because the movie does have a specific tone, it was important that we made sure we shot the script. But because I hired all these great kind of comedic actors that have these improv chops, it would be a waste to not use them. So there's quite a bit of improv, especially kind of during the chaos of not just the family fights, but also the actual physical kind of violence. It was important that I, you know, allow the actors to kind of give those real natural reactions. And when I was in editing, kind of going through everything, it that's where it really paid off dividends, because you need, you know, you need something. Something's not feeling right here. And then you just go through the dailies and you're like, oh my God, look what Meredith Hagner in the corner was doing over there. Let's cut to that. So their improv really helped me out a lot in post.
I think it's a movie, Ike, that'll appeal to both liberals and conservatives, because if you're a conservative, you don't like your character because he's maybe just so deranged and so hell-bent. And for liberals, they'll say, well, yeah, this is the craziness going on. We do need to be acting with this type of vigor right now. Was there anybody you base these characters on? I mean, I think about Hollywood. Obviously, there must be so many types like this. Is there somebody you know or an actor or a friend that you said, you know what, I'm going to do it with this type of sensibility?
You know, I think it was important for us to make sure we are balancing it, because the movie does kind of take a stand, but you know, if you're going to do good satire, you have to kind of shine the light on the absurdity of everyone's behavior. So, you know, for the most part, all these characters are just amalgams of, you know, my friends on the left, including myself sometimes, who are obsessed by the 24-hour news cycle, and they can't, you know, they're letting everything else that they love kind of fall by the wayside. And then I have, you know, friends and family who are on the right, who sometimes I vehemently disagree with their positions, but they're just trying to, you know, they don't want to fight, and I pull the fight out of them. So we really wanted to kind of shine a light on how everyone's brains are kind of breaking in these, you know, insane heightened times.
The Oath is a film from Ike Barinholtz. Blockers is also a really funny movie that you were co-star with this year. Give me the craziest story. I mean, there's obviously so many moments that are inspired and surreal in that movie, but give me the funniest story that happened with you, John Cena and company.
We were shooting the scene where we walk in on Gary Cole and Gina Gershon playing, I guess, sex games. And that was like a 17 or 18 hour shoot. And you have Gary Cole, who's one of my favorite actors, just walking around completely nude in the room with the other men. So it was definitely the longest I had been in a room with a nude man. And after a while, it was just kind of second nature. It was like, oh, yeah, it's Gary's butt. It's totally normal.
Gary Cole, very funny actor. One more for you. I know you got a role, but tell me about Mad TV. My buddy Rick Passmore is a huge fan of you and on that show. And nice. Just how did it inspire you? And maybe a favorite skit, whatever you like.
Gosh, I mean, my favorite sketch, there was one I did with the great Jordan Peele called Killbrain and Astro Man, where it was basically like Superman and Lex Luthor. But we would always run into each other at like mundane places like supermarkets and stuff. And that's the one that I always go back to the most, just because it was with Jordan and they were just such dumb one-off sketches. But they're easily my favorite. And I don't know what Jordan's been up to, and he just kind of disappeared off the map, but I wish him luck.
Yeah, hopefully this filmmaking career. I don't know if maybe you haven't seen Get Out yet, but maybe we'll get a screen to see it. So
I missed that one. I missed that one, but I wish him nothing but the best of luck.
You've been locked into cable news for the last 24 hours and 7 days a week. So totally get it. Ike Barinholtz's film is called The Oath. Make sure you check it out. Ike, where is it available for people? I know in theaters, but where is it? Amazon, Hulu, give them all the spiel there.
This Friday, it's going to be in New York, L.A., and D.C., and then next Friday, it's in theaters everywhere. And I know it's a lot to ask people to go to a movie theater, but I promise this is the kind of movie you want to see in the theater, because you'll laugh and you'll be scared and you'll want to talk about it afterwards.
You take a lot of chances, and I think you're rewarded for it with the hilarity that audiences will enjoy. Thanks so much for the time, man.
Thanks for having me.
And now, a thought from Geico Motorcycle. It took 15 minutes to click on the banner ad entitled, "You Won't Believe What These Child Stars Look Like Now." Be dissatisfied, and kinda sad, about how the child stars look. And now your computer is plagued by incessant pop-up ads.
Oh, this can't be good.
To add insult to injury, you could have used those 15 clickbait minutes to switch your motorcycle insurance to Geico. Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on motorcycle insurance.
Well, it's a real pleasure here on Cinephile to talk to people that I admire. One of them is Ty Burr. I grew up reading his reviews in Entertainment Weekly, always dissected all of his analysis, and now he's a wonderful film critic, one of the best in the country. He writes for the Boston Globe, and he is a guy who I've always wanted to talk to. Ty, thanks so much for the time today.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate the kind words.
So I went back and watched Vertigo again, just because why not? It's one of the great movies of all time. And I remembered your review of it. It's in that Entertainment Weekly compendium of the greatest films of all time. And I'll never forget that. This might be the all-time best blurb in terms of being succinct and talking about a great movie. I don't know if you remember it, but you wrote, "If there's ever been a better movie about a man in love, I've never seen it."
I might rewrite that now.
Why?
It sound like if there's ever been a more twisted but possibly truthful portrait of a man obsessing over love, that's probably closer to the mark. Man, I wrote that, must have wrote that 20 years ago. It's a fantastic movie, and probably the one that's closest to Hitchcock's heart, if not his, you know, inner demons. But it is, it's actually a movie, I think, that is more and more relevant to some of the conversations we're having today, about the way men can try and mold women into the people they think they want them to be, which is what the entire second half of that movie is about. And the fact that you have Jimmy Stewart, one of the most trusted men in classic movies, doing that obsessive molding is even weirder.
And I think that's part of the beauty of the film, Ty. When I watched it again, I remember when I watched it in my 20s, I didn't understand that whole drawn-out sequence where he's following her. I just thought, okay, why it's a little pedantic. Why isn't he speeding this up? When I watched it now, I said, no, that's brilliant. Look at how he's just slowly conveying this man falling in love with her at a distance. And you mentioned, right. I mean, that second half is where I really think the movie's incredible. I mean, the scene where she comes out after he's completely made her over into what this image of this woman that he's lost. I mean, that's his, as you said, it's heartbreaking and harrowing and also just demented.
Right. All of the above. I think that's all intended. When you look at the structure of the movie, the fact that Hitchcock basically gives away the mystery at the midpoint, he basically says, here's what's going on. I've solved the mystery for you. Okay, now what are we supposed to be paying attention to? We're supposed to be paying attention to Scotty's obsession and what it's doing to him and what it's doing to her.
My brother, who doesn't share my cinematic taste, I'm so proud of him, though. He watched Vertigo for me because he heard me talking about it on this podcast. He said his primary quibble is this. I said, I'm sure you hated it. He goes, I didn't hate it, but I don't believe that Scotty would fall in love with her from a distance. Do you have an answer to that comment?
Oh, no, you either buy in or you don't. I mean, I think if they made this movie today, which I hope they never do, that they would probably sketch in some more of a psychological backstory to, you know, to explain why he would fall for, you know, somebody at that distance of that type. The only psychological backstory you get is that he's afraid of heights. And that's the, you know, the setup. That's the very first scene, that very, very first image. But I think if you come to it with a modern sensibility, yeah, you're going to be dissatisfied with certain things. I remember when this movie came, this movie was unable to be seen for a number of years. I forget how many years, but it was a rights issues held up four Hitchcock movies from being seen for a number of decades. And then the rights issues were cleared up and the films were re-released to theaters in the 80s. So it was a, kind of a big deal. It's the first time people had a chance to see Rope, The Trouble with Harry, Vertigo, and I can't remember the fourth one off the top of my head. Oh, was it Rear Window?
Yeah, it was Rear Window.
Might have been. Yeah. So it was a big deal, especially with Rear Window and Vertigo, which were probably the two best known. And I remember everybody sort of rushing out to see Vertigo in theaters, or all the film people I knew. And there was a certain amount of disappointment, or rather a coming to terms with the weird way that film is structured. And yes, that long tailing scene where he follows us around San Francisco, it's if you don't know what's going on, it makes more psychological sense than movie narrative sense. So it kind of took people. It's a movie that you need to see more than once, I think, to really have its claws sink into you. But it, to me, it's one of the most effective psychological portraits of a man in obsessive love. Not just a man in love, but a man in obsessive love, or a person in obsessive love and what it does to them and to the people around them.
1,000%. Ty Burr is our guest right now on Cinephile. He is the terrific film critic for the Boston Globe. He's also a prolific author, Gods Like Us, on movie stardom and modern fame. So I read this book, and here's what I need to know about you, Ty, because how can you be in this society right now, 2018, I'm sure you have family, you have iPhones, you have commitments all the time, and yet nobody knows more about silent films and movies of 100 years ago than you. To give this perspective, if somebody asked me a silent film that I love, I'd tell them I love Sunrise, Murnau's film. That's like asking somebody who likes romantic films, what's your favorite one, Titanic. Like, that's a very obvious big one in that silent film world that I love Sunrise. How in the world did you become an expert on these movies made from decades and decades and decades ago?
Well, first of all, I'm hardly the world's foremost expert on silent films. There's so many people who know so much more about that field than I do. And in fact, there is a huge community of people, especially in the digital age, who are discovering these films and restoring them and getting them out there on DVD and other outlets. It's actually the restoration movement has really taken off in recent decades, thanks, you know, to high profile people like Martin Scorsese pushing the conception that we have to hold on to these cultural treasures, and when we find them, restore them, or they're lost forever. But, you know, to your question, Jesus, you know, I've been a movie geek since I was a teenager. You know, the bug bit me when I was 14, and I've just been watching. I'm 61 now. Somebody asked me, you know, somebody asked how many movies I see. I argue that I probably see about a movie a day when you average it all out, but I've been doing that for, you know, 45 years. So I've seen a lot of movies and you've seen a lot of movies, and there are certain rabbit holes you want to go down. You know, when you get into a subject, you follow the threads where they take you. And yeah, especially when I was writing that book, which was basically a cultural history of stardom, of modern media fame. And you have to start at the beginning. Well, who's the first movie star? Who's the real first movie star? Well, it happened to be a woman named Florence Lawrence, which was a name I had never heard before. So researching that and going down that rabbit hole was revelatory and lots of fun too. And that's really what sparked my deeper interest in silent film beyond, you know, being a film studies major and watching a lot of, you know, old Buster Keaton movies. And like I said, I found I had company. There's a real strong community of people fascinated by silent film. You know, there are film festivals dedicated to it. There are DVD labels dedicated to it. It's actually, it's history, but it's captured on media. It's like the first history we have captured on media in a way beyond literature and beyond print and beyond still photography. So we still have that. We still have films from, you know, 1898, from 1885. That's kind of fascinating. And it's fun to pay attention to that. And it's fun to dig deeper into that.
Yeah. Owen Gleiberman, your old colleague at Entertainment Weekly, he wrote in his book, Movie Freak, that he watches three or four movies a week. And what the challenge becomes is that you've got to see these films that are new releases, of course, for your job or your vocation. But then you mix in movies, as you said, your personal passion for, like you just feel like watching a Marlena Dietrich film. And then there might be a movie that your child wants to see or your spouse wants to see. And then, oh, by the way, everybody's telling us all the time, guys like you and me, oh, it's a golden age of television. You got to watch Bloodline and Scream. And you go, no, I don't have time for that. I've got to just focus on movies. That's my passion. That's my art. And if I'm going to miss Game of Thrones, well, so be it.
Yes, it ends up being a juggling act. And by the way, I do watch Game of Thrones.
Nice.
And I do watch a lot of series. And I do watch a lot of new releases for my job. And I do watch a lot of older films I teach as well and for, you know, other projects I'm writing. And sometimes I just like to watch something for pleasure.
Yeah.
You know, and I will give a shout out to Filmstruck, the streaming platform, subscription streaming platform, which has the best of classic films and foreign films. I'm on that platform, you know, twice a week at least, just for my own pleasure. You know, but the other thing is, as I get older, I also value time spent in the real world, especially in this particular environment. So balancing that is our challenge. I know what one thing that I'm struggling to do is putting down the phone, putting down this little thing in my hand that I stare at far too much time during the day. I'm trying to, you know, modify that. Screen time, you know, screen time is like think about how many hours of the day we spend in screen time, you know, with our head in a screen. So I am trying to manage that. And I think that's actually the challenge of all of us in modern America. How do we manage that and still live in the real world and still value the real world? Which is maybe not something you want to hear from a movie critic, but it's the truth.
Yeah, I just picture you in darkened theaters, ignoring all people and being as antisocial as possible. That's the life that I envision.
I walk my dog a lot. I'm out on my bicycle a lot. I actually try and live in the real world as much as possible.
Shout out to Filmstruck, by the way. You're right. Our buddy Ben Mankiewicz at TCM turned me on to that, and it is it's definitely a rabbit hole once you go down there. You can't even get
absolutely.
Out of it.
Absolutely. But for a beginning, somebody who's just getting into film and classic film, it's a godsend. It's film 101 right there.
Yeah, no, there's no question about it. Obviously, you're one of the best film critics in the country, as I said. You've down to an art form. I'm sure it's like a tennis player at this point. You're just hitting ground strokes left and right. Take me through the process. How long does it take to actually craft the review? You watch A Star Is Born. You're at a critic screening. How long does it take for you to actually put pen to paper and get the thing done?
Well, let me see. So a good example is the new movie, The Hate U Give, which I was just about to sit down and write before we spoke, and I will start writing after I hang up. I saw that movie last week, I think last Wednesday at a screening, last Thursday, at a press screening. And I just filled out the content info box, which is, you know, the stars, the running time, the screenwriters, so, you know, all the MPA rating the theaters it's going to be. And now I'm going to sit down and write the review. And that's probably going to take me about a couple of hours. And I think for me, not the hardest part, but the most important part initially is the hook, is the sentence or two that's going to start it and hopefully pull readers in and give them an angle to come at this particular 2-hour film experience. What am I going to set the table with? How am I going to draw them in? And I haven't figured that out yet. Am I going to mention something about the acting, something about the theme, something about pose a question? I mean, there's so many different ways into setting the table for a review. And then you start, you know, talking a little bit about what it's about, a little bit about the plot, not too much about the plot, what relevance in this case it has to the real world, because it's about a police shooting of an African-American teenager, and the main character's response to that, what you need to know about the star, Amanda Stenberg, the director, George Tillman Jr., even the screenwriter, Audrey Wells, who passed away this past weekend or late last week. You know, that's something I probably would mention further down. It's like juggling a chainsaw, a bowling ball, and a cat. You know, you've got all these different elements, and they sort of combine differently on the page each time. You don't want to give away too much of the plot. You don't want to overwhelm it with subjective opinion. It's, I always think of a review as subjective opinion wrapped in an objective context. Factoids, stuff you really need to know. But yes, here's my opinion. Here's what I think works. Here's what I think doesn't work. Your mileage may vary, but it's that sort of careful essaying of it. You try and end it with something interesting, with a kicker of some sort that will kick the reader out to go see the movie or not go see the movie or what have you. So I've been doing it for so many years now. You don't want it to become rote. You don't want to get in a rut. You do want to, try and keep it changed up. But it takes me a couple of hours, depending on the film. I'm seeing First Man, the new Damien Chazelle movie, with Ryan Gosling playing Neil Armstrong landing on the moon. I'm seeing that again tonight. I saw it in Toronto last month. And that's going to be, I want to get that one right. So that's probably going to take a little longer to write. You want to get all of them right, but some of them come out easily and some of them take more work. You never kind of know how that's going to go.
No, I can appreciate the dedication of the craft because it certainly comes out in your work. Last one for you. We're talking with Ty Burr, the film critic of the Boston Globe. So I adore Scorsese. You mentioned him earlier, just how important he is in film preservation and just being a master filmmaker. I have this debate with myself and with people I love and admire. So you are now on that list, my friend. What is Scorsese's top five films? And I'll set this up for you by saying, I think Raging Bull, Taxi Driver, and Goodfellas are indisputable. I would argue Mean Streets, despite the fact my producer Dan Stanzik just watched it for the first time, found it a little underwhelming. I think it's at four just because it was so influential at the time. And it obviously was the forerunner of so many movies and so personal and autobiographical to Marty's life and his own career. What is the fifth best film of his career? Because it could be Gangs of New York, although I believe you called the film... I think you called it Elephantine, I believe, because it does have some issues. But I would argue it's Age of Innocence, which no one mentions. It's atypical in Marty's career. Criterion just released a new edition of it, which I just picked up. And I think it's criminally underrated. But New York, New York's a movie I love. I know people didn't like it in the time in 77. Bad Last Temptation, I know people argue for. Silence, maybe. The Departed. Which one for you is number five?
All right. Wait a minute. I'm calling up the filmography here. Hold on a second.
Because you want to get this one right. I know it's not going to be Kundun.
I do. Okay, here we go. First of all, I really honestly believe that Mean Streets belongs on that list. I think, yes, it's a 50-year-old film. And so it is dated in some ways, but I think it is still just there's so much energy. There's so much energy just bursting to get out, both in the performances, certainly De Niro, but in the filmmaking. I need to go back and see Age of Innocence. It's a movie that people I respect, think really highly of. And I remember I found it kind of inert when it came out, but I haven't seen it since 1993, since it came out. So it's a movie I really need to revisit.
What about King of Comedy?
King Comedy, I love, but I don't know if I'd put it in the pantheon.
All right.
You said Raging Bull.
Raging Bull, Taxi Driver, Goodfellas. Yeah, those are
right.
No-brainer.
Okay, absolutely. I'm not going to go The Departed despite being from Boston.
Yeah. You're not going to go The Color Money.
That's a pretty good film.
Shutter Island, you're not going to say. Cape Fear, you're not saying.
You know what was what's one maybe Casino,
wow.
Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore is a pretty darn good movie.
Yeah,
nobody sees that.
Ellen Burstyn.
You know what's one of my favorites, and that it's hardly anybody even knows it exists.
Is it Life Lessons from New York Stories?
No, that's great though. Oh, nice. After Hours.
Oh yeah,
around the same era.
Yeah,
which is. To me, it's a better Kafkaesque comedy than King of Comedy. But I can, I love that movie, but I can see people, resisting if I put on my top five of all best Scorsese movies.
This is going to keep you up all night.
It is going to keep me up all night.
Okay, Hugo. Right. Hugo, you're a film lover. Hugo. It's got to be Hugo.
I love that movie. It doesn't feel to me like a... I don't think it's one of Scorsese's best.
It's film preservation. It's so personal to Marty.
Well, exactly. It's the preservationist in him coming out. It's his most truest room as a preservationist, but I feel like there are other movies that are probably more personal in different ways. Last Temptation of Christ is actually a pretty intense and good film, and I would argue that that Silence is a movie that will be regarded as much more important to the filmography. The one that came out 2 years ago, about the Jesuit priests in Japan. It's not an easy watch, and it sort of goes hand in hand with Last Temptation and Kundun as part of this sort of religious trilogy. But it's very, very strong. And I think we may, in retrospect, look at that as a late peak in Scorsese's career.
I couldn't agree with you more, Ty. I think when there's a Scorsese one-on-one course, people are taking NYU, they're going to focus on the ones we talked about. And you're right, After Hours may be a lesser work, but I agree with you. It was important in his career. Won the Palme d'Or and got him back on his feet after
That's the disappointment.
Yeah.
Wow.
But after the disappointment of Cannes Comedy, especially with the box office. But I'm with you. Silence is one of those that if you know Scorsese's themes, and again, the way he shot it, the themes of formalism and the fact it wasn't very busy with the camera, very little score, I'm with you. I think Silence will be better received over the years.
Yeah, so that's got my vote for the fifth.
I love it. Ty Burr, he is a wonderful film critic and obviously a wonderful human being. Check out his work in the Boston Globe along with his book, Gods Like Us. If you love silent films in that era as much as I do, you will love it. Ty, this is a real pleasure, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Adam. It's been a real pleasure being on. Thanks.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Cinephile. God, it was so much fun to geek out with Ty Burr. I could have done that for hours. He's a wonderful film critic. Once again, check out his work. And Ike Barinholtz, well, I didn't know his work that well, but I thought he was hilarious in Blockers. His new movie, The Oath, I really think you should check out because, as I said, he takes chances and it's a wild and frenetic ride. And A Star Is Born, let us know what you think. You can tweet us your review at Cinephile ESPN. And once again, please do give us some love on iTunes. And thanks to my man Ben Lyons, now a member of the BFCA, Broadcast Film Critics Association. We're puffing our chests about that. Next time on the pod, I'm telling you right now, Robert Forster, one of the all-timers, 52-year career as a veteran character actor. We talk about his new film called What They Had with Michael Shannon and Hilary Swank. He's also got tremendous stories about working with the legendary director John Huston, Marlon Brando, Elizabeth Taylor, Naked Guy on a Horse, Tarantino and Jackie Brown. It's unbelievable. I'm telling you right now, Robert Forster coming up, one of the best interviews we've ever done. That'll be on the next Cinephile. Until then, I'll see you at the movies.
Don't miss out on the next episode of Cinephile. Subscribe to the Adnan Virk Movie Podcast by clicking the Listen tab in the ESPN app.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.